From NPR in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Almost everyone has played the lottery once or twice, lured by the possibility of making a killing on a dollar bet. Playing the numbers, as it's known in many communities, is a popular pastime that goes back to the late 1800s. In Chicago's African-American Bronzeville community, those who controlled the game used their profits to make the neighborhood a mecca of economic and political power. Our reporter, Allison Keys, recently spoke with Nathan Thompson. He's the author of Kings, the True Story of Chicago's Policy Kings and Numbers Racketeers.
Nathan, I know it took you 10 years to write this book. What inspired you to start this whole journey?
Well, in a nutshell, the thing that actually got me motivated was at one point with all of my fascination with gangster movies, everything from James Cagney to The Godfather, it occurred to me one day I knew more about the history of the Italian mob than I did about my own history as an African American. And you always wonder how come they don't put any black guys in any of these cool movies. And
right.
One day I went in search looking for information about the black gangsters of the old days. And what actually happened was I walked into the biggest history lesson of my life.
For our listeners that don't know, what are the numbers and how do you play them?
It's what you know today as your state lottery. But before it was the state lottery, it was conceived, owned, and operated by African-American men, and it was called policy. You place your money on a bet. Say, for example, you want to pick three numbers, 12, 16, 18. You know, if you put a nickel on that money, on that bet back in the days, that would win you fast $5 if you were a winner. And the thing about policy is back in its heyday, it not only put food on the tables of many people, but it provided untold numbers of jobs. The experience acquired by the people that worked in the policy business ranges from everything from bookkeeping and accounting to, you know, anything you can get a job for today. In those days, mm-hmm. you could have that same employment in the policy business.
When did the policy racket really start?
Credited with being the inventor of the game is a man named Sam Young, known as Policy Sam Young, who hit Chicago in 1885 with a lottery game of sorts that he reinvented, customized particularly for the taste of African Americans. And it goes from his street corner hustle at the corner of State and Madison in Chicago, which at that time was the busiest corner in the world, and mm-hmm. through a series of progressions and political regime changeovers, it becomes the biggest black-owned and operated business in the world. And it was not just limited to Chicago. The thing about the policy racket is that there was a national brotherhood of policy kings stretched from one end of the country to the other. And it's what brought many of these historic black communities into fruition. And they took that illegal numbers game, but they created all of these great positive things. We're talking about the rebirth of the Negro Baseball League. We're talking about money that was used to send people to school to acquire educations who came out, launched their own practices in law, in accountants, bookkeepers, doctors, dentists, the contributions that were made to different schools and the money that was provided for needy children for clothes and books for school. And again, the list goes on and on and on. These guys were known as the Robin Hoods of the neighborhood.
Some of the great stories in your book. Talk to us about Johnny Woolley in the Vienna Hotel at 39th and Indiana.
Johnny Woolley is the guy that I dubbed the king of the speakeasies. You know, throughout my research, it just seemed like John Woolley was opening a speakeasy every 5 minutes. I mean, I think at one time he owned as many as six or seven that were operating in Chicago at one time. But think about John Woolley. This is a brother, a black guy who was working in the earlier days as a truck driver for Al Capone. And he gets into the speakeasy business and gets into the bootleg liquor business and ultimately gets into the policy business with one of his best friends, Ed Jones, the king of policy mm-hmm. kings.
Didn't he buy the hotel at 39th and Indiana after they refused him service?
Yes, he goes in for service one day and he's refused service because he's a black guy. So not to be outdone, Johnny Woolley comes back the next day, buys the place and fires everybody. Subsequently, the Vienna hotel and bath becomes kind of the hot springs of Chicago. Old timers were still around today, still talk about the Vienna bath.
Describe Bronzeville of the 1930s and 40s to us.
Bronzeville of the 1930s and 40s was one of the greatest places to be for anybody, but particularly if you were African American. The thing about Bronzeville, south side of Chicago, is the Great Black Migration was actually what Robert Abbott dubbed the Great Northern Drive. Robert Abbott being the founder of the Chicago Defender newspaper that's largely responsible for bringing African Americans from the South to the North, in this case particularly Chicago, because of the tremendous jobs that were available. But more than that, because of the political climate that was going on that enabled African Americans to live in a way that they couldn't live in the South. The policy kings were in control of the black vote here. And that set the stage for what African Americans would and would not be able to do. So Brownsville was just that, I hate to use the term promised land, but it tends to come back to that. It was a much better way of life in the North, particularly here in Chicago, than it was in the South. And for that matter, Harlem. You know, in 1938, Time magazine dubbed Brownsville as the U.S. Center of Negro Business. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a powerful statement coming from Time magazine, particularly during the Depression, which we have come to know as one of the most racial times for African Americans. But the larger message there was that here, during the Depression, about the only guys that seem to be making any money are these black guys on the south side of Chicago in a place called Brownsville. And the policy money had everything to do with that.
You've said that policy kings weren't hoodlums, they were racketeers. Explain the difference.
Right. They were not gangsters. Now, there were plenty of black gangsters around in those days, but the policy kings right? were not gangsters. They were racketeers, and the difference is simply this. The racketeer uses the gun to protect what he has. The gangster uses the gun to get what he wants. In those days, your grandmother could walk down the street down at 47th and South Parkway at 1 o'clock in the morning. Nobody would bother her. That's not going to happen today. So there was a whole different climate. There was a whole different vibe going on with African Americans in those days. Much more positive vibe. One that said to ourselves, we can produce what we need. We don't have to go begging the government for it. That's why Brownsville became great. We couldn't go downtown. We couldn't go to, you know, to the big banks and get a business loan. So where do you go if you want to start a grocery store, a drugstore, or whatever? You go to the policy king. He's going to give you the money to do it. He's going to give you the backing to do it. And he's going to provide the muscle, if needed, when you need it, for anybody that wants to bother you.
What ended the reign of the policy kings? The white mafia couldn't have been very pleased about all this money in the black community.
Yeah, well, you know, it went from us, then it went to the mob, then the government took it away from the mob. And the thing that Ed Jones in 1940s goes to prison for tax evasion. There he comes in contact with Sam Giancana, who would go on to be instrumental in conquering the black policy racket. Interesting side note there, it's been debated that Sam Giancana himself may not ever have become the head of the Chicago mob had it not been for him delivering the policy racket into the hands of the people, you know, he was looking up to and wanted to be involved with. Ultimately, they take over the rackets after a series of kidnappings and bombings and what have you. And the last holdout is Ted Rowe, who went on to become the king of policy kings, who came up with the Jones brothers. And he fought Sam Giancana and the mob toe to toe. The man had no fear. They weren't no punks, as they say these days.
Tell me what today's community of color can learn from what the kings did.
It's a side of black history that has never been taught in school, but it is vitally important if we are upset with our young people for they don't know nothing. Well, it's our responsibility to make sure that they do. And this part of history has never been presented. I think it presents a reason why they should care, why they should get involved, to know what we once had and what we think we want is achievable because we've done it before. And Kings is the living proof that we have done this before.
Nathan Thompson, author of Kings, the true story of Chicago's policy kings and numbers racketeers, joins us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
The Tavis Monday Show is a news and opinion program created by NPR and the African American Public Radio Consortium. The show is produced by Cheryl Flowers, edited by Philip Martin, and directed by Devin Robbins. Our technical director is Theo Mondo. Carlos Asensio is our engineer. Our production staff includes Toya Baker, Ben Elkin, Roy Hurst, Kyle McKinnon, Corey Moore, Therese Sims, Sarah Spivak, Nathan Thompson, and Tashima Walker. Our theme music was composed by George Duke. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is NPR. Keep the faith.